From WMRA and James Madison University's College of Arts and Letters, this is the John Grisham Writers Hour. With millions of books sold and 40 novels under his belt, John Grisham is a criminal justice reform advocate, best known for legal thrillers like The Firm. He sat down with Alice McDermott, award-winning novelist who also worked at Lynchburg College in Virginia as a writer in residence. Here's what happened when these two writers got together for the John Grisham Writers Hour at James Madison University in March 2019. John Grisham starts the conversation.
Thank all y'all for being here. I'm delighted to be back on campus for the second installment of the Writers Hour, and happy to welcome tonight one of my favorite writers. Alice McDermott is no stranger to Virginia. She, in years past, has studied and stayed at the Virginia Center for Creative Arts at Sweetbriar. She has been the writer-in-residence at Lynchburg College. She is currently the teacher of creative writing at Johns Hopkins. If you don't know where Alice McDermott's from, it's because you haven't read her books. She is one of the few great literary artists who has staked her claim to her own little corner of the world. Think of Dickens in London. Think of Mark Twain in Hannibal, Missouri. Think of William Faulkner in Yaknapatawpha County in Mississippi. Alice doesn't claim to own all of New York and Long Island, just the Irish Catholic parts of it. In one quietly absorbing book after another, she has chronicled the histories and experiences of New York's Irish Catholic immigrants in the first half of the last century. 8 novels in all, each a major publishing event, each admired, even adored by the critics, each eagerly awaited by her fans, who sometimes have to wait as long as 6 years for the next book. She has won too many awards to mention here. 3 of her books, their novels, including That Night in 1987, At Weddings and Wakes, 1992, and After This, in 2006, were shortlisted for the Pulitzer. In 1998, she won the National Book Award for her 4th novel and perhaps her most famous book, Charming Billy. Please welcome Alice McDermott.
Thank you so much. 8 books doesn't sound like so much all of a sudden. I got to get writing.
We'll talk about that later. We'll talk about your pace later.
Okay? Consult my husband.
So you're no stranger to Virginia.
No stranger to Virginia. No, just live on the other side of the Potomac Ocean in Maryland. Actually, when we first moved from the West Coast to Bethesda, my husband and I thought maybe we made a mistake in choosing our home, because every time we got in the car, no matter where we were going, the Kennedy Center or to the mall, we would end up in Virginia. It just drew us, lost hopelessly, but in Virginia.
So what are you doing these days at Hopkins?
I am about to end my teaching career and retire at the end of the semester, but I am teaching a...
Does that mean more books at a more rapid pace? Or?
There you go. Yeah, I got to start. The pressure
no
is
excuses,
on.
No excuses.
The pressure is on. I don't know how many years I've got, but I got to do at least 40 more books.
So you will write more?
Yes, I'm going to see if this full-time writing thing is all that it's cracked up to be. But I love teaching, and I have a great group of 8 young, brilliant fiction writers in a seminar this semester, and I am making them all write short novels, under 200 pages, and we're reading.
That's your preferred length.
You know, you can get invested in the way you might not be invested in a short story in The New Yorker, but you can also see the end coming, you know, so you have a nice sense of, boy, this is going to end soon. And I think sometimes I think you pay more attention when it's a lighter book.
My books are getting thinner because I'm getting lazier. Except for the last book, The Reckoning came out in October of last year, and I usually aim for around 100,000 words, which is 350 to 400 pages, you know, of a printed novel. And that's enough for me. I don't want to read a book that thick. And I got kind of carried away with the last one, and No one can tell us how many words to write. There's no limit. No one can put a limit on us. How many pages, how many words. We can write a 1,000-page novel, and some people do. Mm-hmm. And I can't read that many pages. So it's I admire your, not your brevity, but your efficiency, because all of your books come in at around 200 pages. They're loaded with stories and characters and, you know, all the things we come to expect from you, but you don't get carried away. You don't waste many words.
Well, I do get carried away, but I leave it out. I write a good deal more than I keep, a lot more than I keep. So I probably have written 1,000-page novels. It's just I know that 800 of those pages should not be hoisted on any reader.
Was it Elmore Leonard who said he doesn't write the parts that people skip? Or people skim. He doesn't
right.
write the parts that people skim. Just don't put them in there. If you're going
right.
to skim them, don't put them in there.
Right, right.
That's my theory. So can we ask what you're writing now?
I am well into my next novel, but I have, as we were saying earlier, I have a very bad habit that I developed after I published my first book. It's don't do it. If you're a writer, don't do it. It's bad advice, but I always work on two novels somewhat simultaneously. And sometimes one pulls ahead and gets finished, and sometimes the other one sort of disappears. Sometimes the other one becomes something else. So I've got two novels, one I'm well into and one that's taking shape. So when I either despair or get bored with one, I have something else that looks much better that I can go back to.
Can I assume that both these books are about Irish people?
No, you cannot.
Okay, let's be honest here. You have 8 books.
All right.
All about Irish Catholics in New York in the last century.
Right.
It's time to branch out a little bit, okay? Are you going to do that? Or do you refuse to talk about it?
No, it doesn't trouble me. I always think each time I'm in the middle of a book, it feels totally new to me. I think I'm discovering a new world and new characters. I always try to avoid anything from the outside of my imagination and the words on the page from influencing the stories I tell or the characters or what they do or how they behave. So what I've published before becomes totally irrelevant to me when I start a new novel. If it has to be about Irish Americans, it's about Irish Americans. If it doesn't, it won't be.
All right, let's talk about Irishness, okay?
Yeah, okay.
How far back do your ancestors go, the ones who immigrated?
My grandparents were all Irish born.
All 4 grandparents?
All 4 grandparents.
And do you know from, I'm sure you do, what part of Ireland they're from?
I do. They were from 4 different places and all emigrated separately. So Donegal, County Mayo, or the McDermotts, County Kerry, and County Cork.
And they met over here?
And they all met in New York, got married, had a lot of children, and died young, all 4 of them. I never knew any of them.
So they came over when? Late 1800s?
They came over early 1900s. My McDermott, I do have the citizenship papers for my grandfather, Thomas McDermott, and he became a citizen in 1902.
That was the second great wave of Irish immigration.
Yes, right, right. Yeah, they made it through the potato famine. My father used to say because they were horse stealers. I don't know.
Why did they immigrate? Like the same reason everybody else? Just a better chance to get ahead?
I don't know.
They weren't starving as they had been 50 years earlier, right?
I don't think so. Adventurous, maybe. My mother was raised by her aunt, and so she was the closest thing I had to a grandmother. And she was, from my mother's family, she was the first one to come over. And even as kids, if we asked her, she had a heavy brogue, which she denied. And anytime we asked her, you know, anything about Ireland, she just said bitter memories, didn't want to talk about it. Brooklyn was the best place to live. That's all I knew. So in some ways, writing about Irish Americans as a novelist is a way of recreating what I don't know.
How do you do the research into the way people lived and died and survived 100 years ago? These scenes recur all the time in your 8 novels. You didn't live that. Where do you get the information?
No.
It's so rich in detail.
I always start with the character. I have to create the character and I have to hear the voice of the storyteller. So I have to start writing. If I do research first, I'll never make it to the page. Research is too much fun for me. So I start writing first, not knowing, but imagining, letting the language sort of be an incantation of sorts. Where are we? Who are these people? What's the scene? And then I start to figure out who's telling the story, who are these people, and then I learn what I don't know. And then I can do research. Then I know what I'm looking for. I have a sense of who this person is. Now I have to make sure I have the right details. But I don't want to find the historical details first and then surgically insert them into a character.
I agree. Right? You can't. If you start with the research, you don't know what you need, and you don't know where you're going, and you don't know what you're going to find, and it's a waste of time.
Yeah, I'm sure we've all read novels where suddenly a lot of interesting information that doesn't really have anything to do with the story thus far.
The writer's showing off.
The writer, yeah.
I'll make a list of all the places I have to go to as I write the novel in the first draft. And the first draft is a pretty clean draft by the time I clean it up. I know where I have to go specifically, what I have to see, who I have to talk to, and it saves so much time with the research. But you enjoy the research.
Yeah, I enjoy when I know what I'm looking for. For this last novel, The Ninth Hour, I had so much fun with the research because once I realized who the storyteller was, where the novel opened, who the characters were, I went back and started reading a lot of newspapers from the era, especially the Brooklyn Eagle, which was the newspaper of choice for people in Brooklyn in those years. And the wonderful thing that not even looking for anything specific, but just seeing what was going on. What were people reading about? What were the advertisements? What did the want ads look like? And when you read newspapers from a specific era, you find out something about the way language was used. Newspapers didn't sound the same way they did now, and especially the women's section with the gossip and the wedding announcements. And the stories of divorce, what made people nervous, and how flowery the language was. And you can use that to sort of shape how characters view their own lives. That was great fun. If you're ever looking for a topic for a novel, I know you never run out, but read the Brooklyn Eagle from the 1930s.
Was that the paper favored by the Irish?
It was Brooklyn. It was not just the Irish.
And at one point, there were 10 daily newspapers in Brooklyn.
Yes, yeah, but the Eagle was, and the Eagle's all online, too, so it's now available. But wonderful stories, mafia stories, and, again, society divorces, and tragic stories of children falling into the Gowanus Canal, written in flowery language. The racism is astonishing. I found one story that was about a little Italian boy who fell into the Gowanus Canal, and there were competing funeral homes, Italian funeral homes. The kid was hauled out of the canal, and these two funeral directors came from different directions and fought over the body, and a riot broke out.
And there were some trial lawyers.
Exactly. And, of course, the police were called. The police were involved. A number of people were stabbed. One of the funeral directors ended up in the hospital, and after accounting this whole thing, the reporter wrote, "Oh, but they were Italian. You know how they are."
When you started that book, The Ninth Hour, did you know you were going to write a book about nuns?
Oh, God, no. No.
How did that happen?
Oh, the last thing I wanted to do, you know, I try to shake this, not only the Irish-American, but the Irish-Catholic label. If my characters happen to be Catholic, that doesn't mean I'm writing a Catholic book. But I wanted to write about caretaking. I wanted to write about how we take care of one another in any given life. And this nun, this nursing sister, showed up in the first chapter. And I knew I could kill her off by the end of the first chapter and I wouldn't have to have a novel about nuns. But in those days, nuns very seldom traveled alone. And although she appears alone, very quickly, before I could get to the end of the first chapter, two more nuns came in and I couldn't kill all three of them off.
I could have.
Not if they had a good lawyer.
Do you enjoy killing off your characters?
That one I did, yeah.
Depends.
It depends.
What's the most gruesome way you've killed one? That guy in the first chapter of Ninth Hour, that was pretty gruesome. The suicide.
I mean, nothing terribly elaborate. I haven't gotten to anything terribly graphic yet, but it could happen. No, I think it's that inevitable thing that you run into, especially if you're trying to follow a character or two through any length of time, our mortality is going to come up one way or another. And it seems to me if you're trying to write honestly and authentically about what it is to be human at any given place or time, mortality has to figure into it, and it happens.
I'm writing a book now that'll come out in October, and a couple of weeks ago I had to write this really horrible scene where some drug dealers, some really bad characters, needed to execute a couple of informants, and they did it by feeding the two guys to a bunch of crocodiles. And it's pretty sick. Mm. And my wife, you know, read that and walked into my office and said, where in God's name did this come from? You know, this is the worst thing you've ever written, okay? It's terrifying. This couldn't really happen. And I said, oh, yes, it really happened. You know, sometimes I guess to be sensational, you have to watch stuff like that because you can always overdo it. You have a way of...
I don't know how you could underdo being by a crocodile.
I may have to change that. I may edit that out. That may not survive.
It's a subtle death by crocodile.
That may not last. I may have to go back and redo that one. But there are some characters you get attached to. You don't want to die, but you have to. And anyway, it's always a struggle about who lives and who survives
Our novels. Yeah. Well, I knew with Charming Billy, that was a novel that began for me with a character. Actually, my third novel was really the first time that I used the Irish-American community. And I thought it would be the one and only time I would use the Irish-American community because I wanted to write something about storytelling between generations. Not just what gets told, but what is never told interested me. And I thought I was finished with those people. But then I realized that there was a caricature, a stereotype within that community that I hadn't really addressed, and that's the lovable drunk. It's a complete Irish-American stereotype. The Irish don't have an anti-defamation league, you might notice.
So they need one. Yeah.
They need one, yeah, because people call us drunks, and we go, yeah, sure, fine. Football team, fighting Irish? Yeah, sure, fine. That's us.
Were your ancestors or the people 100 years ago in New York, were they ever subject to racism? You mentioned racism, ethnic racism.
Oh, sure.
In New York City, where there were millions of them.
Sure. Okay. Which is why, I mean, you know, the Irish, I think, especially the generation that my grandparents came out of, and my parents, sort of the World War II generation, they dealt with racism by identifying with the oppressor. My grandmother, who was actually my great aunt, who worked for wealthy people, she was a cook, she came home and she imitated their lifestyle in her little apartment in Brooklyn. So when my mother and her sisters were growing up and coming of age, even though they had a mother who was Irish born with a heavy brogue, they had cocktails in the evening. They drank Manhattans. They subscribed to The New Yorker. They went to Broadway and saw every show. That didn't come from the old country.
Right.
That was not their tradition. But it was, this is how you become an American, and obviously America is the best place to be. That's why we came. So I think that in many ways, the racism they saw as, well, they were also Catholic, as their own faults. Yeah. You know, it was a matter of guilt. If people are treating you poorly because you're Irish, then you're not acting right. Stop acting so Irish. Don't get drunk. Don't go into a bar. Go to the theater. Listen to classical music. Dress nicely. Then they won't be prejudiced against you.
Did they really drink more than other immigrants, the Italians and Germans and?
No, no.
You sure?
I'm pretty sure. They drank. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was part of the culture. But again, that was my own experience, that World War II generation, and many of my friends growing up, parents from that generation, you know, it was not shooting shots of Jameson's and drinking Guinness. It was a kind of sophistication, you know. Their models were Hollywood movies. You know, again, not the old country. Nobody wanted to look back at the old country in that generation.
I have Irish blood on my mother's side. It's not nearly as thick as yours, but it's there, and I was always very much aware of it. Have you done the Ancestry.com thing?
No, I haven't.
Well, you probably don't need to. if you know where all four grandparents came from.
Right, exactly, right.
So my wife and I did it a year or so ago. We saw the ad, and we were kind of curious. So we paid $100 for the kit. We spent mm-hmm. the thing and sent it off, and hoping for something sort of exotic, you know, and got none of that. It was 70% Anglo mutts, like a lot of people. And the only cool thing, my wife is 1% Jewish. Yeah. We have no idea where that comes from.
Yeah.
But I thought, you know, someone like you ought to try. What if you did it and you came back and it said you were not Irish? I mean, that would be pretty.
Well, you know, Henry Louis Gates asked me to do that for his Finding Your Roots show.
Right.
So they sent me actually two different kits, and I did. I did spit it in and sent it out. And they can't find anything interesting.
It's 100%.
So they keep putting me off. Yeah, they said, no, we're going to have you on the show. We're fine. You know, we want it to be a big surprise, so we're not going to tell you. But I'm suspecting they can't find any surprises. It's going to be one of those really boring segments.
Yeah. On my mother's side, there are a bunch of Irish people. And so there's one clan in southern Missouri where my grandmother's from. And it's heavily non-Catholic, no Catholics anywhere around.
Sure.
These are assimilated Southern Baptist Irish people. And this one clan, strict teetotalers. I mean, mm-hmm. not a drop. And they're serious about it. It's just the way they live, like a lot of people in that culture. And the other clan is about 10 miles away, just a bunch of drunks. And they're kin to each other, you know?
Yeah.
So then, of course, the teetotalers always look down on the drunk Irish cousins and back
of course,
and forth. And
right, right.
I've got that rattling around back in my DNA somewhere, but I'm probably not going to write about it.
We had some Irish-born and raised Irish musicians at our house, and we were sitting around and talking about how many Americans have Irish blood and how many people you find who somewhere have Irish blood in their DNA and discover it. And one of the Irish musicians just sort of looked up and said, "That's only because the Irish will sleep with anybody."
Have you, since you write about your, well, you don't write about your family, but you kind of write about your people. Have you ever gotten any blowback from family for things you've written?
I'm not quite sure my family reads my books. No, my poor departed mother, at one point, I think it was when my third novel came out, which again was the first time I really made use of the Irish American community in New York, and my mother read it and she said to me, "I know this isn't our family, but how will anybody else know this isn't our family?" That's being the parent of a writer no matter what.
Yeah. My last conversation with Pat Conroy before he passed away, we didn't know he was sick. We were friends, but we didn't hang out a whole lot. We were just talking about writing and giving each other, you know, a lot of grief about this and about that. And I said, "Pat, I'm sick of reading about your family. You've been beating them up for 20 years. I mean, really beating these people up, and it's caused problems. You know, real problems with his siblings." And I said, "Why can't you move on? Why can't you write about something else?" And he said, "I've tried, but I just keep going back to my turbulent childhood, and there's mm-hmm. so many great stories."
Yeah.
He just could not get away from family. So once again, can you ever get away from the Irish Catholic story?
Again, if a story or a character comes to me and those connections aren't required, then I will follow that.
Have you thought about a legal thriller?
think you have to be a lawyer.
You have two brothers who are
lawyers? I have two brothers who are lawyers, yes. They're always threatening to write novels. Yeah. Because it must be easy if I'm doing it.
Most lawyers are. You were raised in a very Catholic world. I think you said one time in an interview that you were just born Catholic. You grew up Catholic. It's in your DNA. Yeah. And I feel the same way about being Southern Baptist. Mm-hmm. It was not, it was there. I was born to that culture and lived that way for most of my life. I left the church, the Southern Baptist Church, about 25 years ago for various reasons. But you also said that you're not a very good Catholic. Did you say that?
Yes, I did.
Well, great. Wikipedia got it right. Why would you say that?
Well, these days, I say, thank God I'm not a very good Catholic. It's been my escape hatch, I suppose. I don't think you become a writer, and certainly not a fiction writer who's making up worlds, unless you're a contrarian. Things happen in the real world, but not with enough sense, not with enough plot, not with enough justice. So we novelists, we rewrite it. We do better than God, the first creator, just kind of sloppy. We try to do a better job. So I think being a contrarian and being raised in an institution like the Catholic Church, you're never going to be really good at it. You're always going to be saying, yeah, but wait a minute.
Do you have issues with the church today?
Oh my gosh. Yes.
What are your top two?
I think that a friend of mine said this, and I sort of love it. As Catholics, we're at a very exciting time. We're either witnessing the end or witnessing a beginning. And I think that's really true. I don't think the church knows that. I don't think the institutional church understands that the church is under existential threat. It's right. Not just a matter of PR, throw some of these poor guys in jail, these twisted souls, apologize enough, and then move on.
Right.
I think the church, and this is coming from the real church, not the clergy. Clergy isn't the church. The people are the church.
Yeah.
And I think that major changes.
It's time for change.
Major changes. Yeah. A sea change.
You know, it's not just Catholics. I think all denominations are seeing a decline in attendance, membership, activity. Even, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, your big sprawling suburban mega churches sprung up, and they're declining now. And it's not just a Catholic problem. It's a problem that a lot of churches, Protestant churches, are facing. And there are a lot of problems in those churches, too.
Yeah.
We left the Baptist church 25 years ago because we got tired of the politics. It's a very political arm of politics now, uh-huh. And it's not our politics.
Uh-huh.
And that has turned a lot of people away from the church.
Yes.
When a church gets involved in politics, Christ taught that we're supposed to love each other and take care of each other.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And when a church gets involved in politics, and when preachers get involved in politics, they alienate so many people they're supposed to be serving.
Uh-huh.
And so they do a great disservice to the flock, to the people they're supposed to be taking care of.
Another phrase from someone I'm not as fond of as my friend who said that the church was either at the end or the beginning, but that's been haunting me, is Steve Bannon, who used to be in the White House, remember him? When he had that phrase about deconstructing the institutional state, undermining every institution that people have come to rely on or depend on or even to turn to, so that they are seeking in some way to replace it. But first you have to deconstruct the institutional state. So I think it's happening in churches, it's happening in government, it's happening in schools. The scandal with the college admissions, to hear people say, oh my gosh, Yale, I can't believe Yale or Princeton or these wonderful institutions would be involved in such underhanded stuff. And, if all those things are shaken, we're all susceptible to someone who comes along and says, only I can fix it.
Wow.
Not to get political.
What else you want to talk about? What are you reading?
Oh, I am, mostly because I'm teaching this short novel class, I'm revisiting a bunch of really wonderful short novels. So right now I'm rereading I think this may be my third or fourth go-through, James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room, which is a beautiful novel. And also, since we're in Virginia, it's close to the South, Carson McCullers, yeah. A Member of the Wedding. I have my students reading both the novel and the play, which is a great exercise for anyone who wants to see about narrative structure and what gets left out in that transition from on the stage to on the page.
What is your reading history? Beginning as a kid, did you read voraciously even back then?
Yeah, I was always a reader. Reading was important as I was growing up. Trips to the library every week. Read indiscriminately, which is the way I think young people should read. The stuff that you think you're going to like and the stuff that you can't understand why you should be made to read it.
Have you read Game of Thrones?
No.
Are you going to try?
No.
Pat Conroy read three or four or five volumes of the Game of Thrones.
It's really?
A big, thick books, yeah. You know. Yeah. Unlike yours, unlike mine. But he read all of them, and then he went out to Santa Fe and did a thing like this with George R.R. Martin and just had a ball with a guy. He read those books, and that would be...
People love that stuff. It just isn't for me.
You don't do fantasy and science fiction?
No, I have a hard time. I try to help my students who are writing fantasy and science fiction. I think the real world is so rich and so unexplored by most of us living here that I'm perfectly content with realism.
You said you have 8 students now.
Yes.
Is that about average for a semester or for a year?
Yeah, for our MFA program.
For how many years now?
Oh, my gosh. I've been at Hopkins since 96. And as you mentioned, I was writer-in-residence briefly at Hollins in Lynchburg, and I taught at UNH, and I taught at UC San Diego. I love teaching.
How do you feel when you get the email or phone call from one of your students and with the big news that they've been published?
It's marvelous. I won't say his name. I had a phone call. I'm in my office, and I get a phone call from a student who had graduated from Hopkins maybe about 7 or 8 years before. And we had corresponded. I hadn't heard from him in a couple of years. And he called me and said, I'm really sorry. I haven't been in touch. I was starting to get embarrassed. It had been so long since I was in your classroom, since I got my master's. I wasn't publishing anything, and I just was ashamed to be in touch. I just was ashamed of myself. But I'm calling you now to say I just sold my first novel for $1 million.
What was the Bigamist Daughter? What was your advance?
$12,500.
Mine was $15 for Time to Kill. I beat you by $3,000.
Well, you did a little better afterwards. But I said to him, this wonderful, wonderful. So I said, oh my gosh, and think about when the book comes out and you walk into your classroom, into your English classroom, and all those kids are sitting there and they just seen your book in bookstores and they've seen you on TV. Won't that be wonderful? And there's silence. And then he said, oh, I'm not going to be teaching anymore.
You can't tell us who it is?
Well, the writer's life story is, and I even said to him at the time, I know $1 million sounds like a lot, but your agent takes some. And Uncle Sam takes some, and it took you 10 years to write this novel, and it may take you 10 years to write the next one. Mm-hmm. So just think about it. But no, he had just had twins. He was living in a studio apartment in Brooklyn. They bought a house. Everything was wonderful. But it is taking him 10 years to get the second
Those
one.
Deals normally go sour.
Yeah.
Because, and I've watched it for 25 years. I got $15,000 for Time to Kill in 1980, 30 years ago. And so I didn't get the big, the big contract with the first novel. But you see it happen occasionally, mm-hmm. not like it used to because it's more sensible now. But so often you would see $1 million or $2 million advance for first novel, and they almost never worked because it put so much pressure on the publisher mm-hmm. and the marketing and all those people to make it work. And I've had discussions with people in New York about how bad it is for the author's career to start off with a bang like that.
Yes, yeah.
The smartest thing to do is to build your readership gradually and, you know, have a good foundation. But
right.
you see the million-dollar deals like that. I mean, I would have taken one. Who doesn't? Who wouldn't?
Yeah.
But it's not a good idea. I was 30 years old before I started writing anything.
Mm-hmm.
The first word of A Time to Kill was the first fiction I ever wrote. And I'd been a lawyer for 5 years, and I was busy doing that. And this was going to be a little secret hobby nobody knew about, and it was a courtroom drama, blah, blah, blah. But I was 30. I didn't dream of writing when I was a child. I didn't study writing when I was a mm-hmm. student. It just mm-hmm. it came later in life.
Mm-hmm.
Your situation was different. Your background in writing was different, right?
Yeah, I mean, I always wrote as a kid through high school. I went to an all-girl Catholic high school.
What a surprise.
At a time. I don't know why this time happened, but there were some years there that whenever there was anything to celebrate or Teacher's Day or sports night, you put on a skit. I don't know why that was. That was a culture I don't understand, although I grew up in it.
It must be a Catholic thing.
It must have. Well, so I was the skit writer. For 4 years, I was the go-to skit writer. Anybody needed a skit, I wrote. Never occurred to me to be a writer. Never occurred to me that it was a career. I went to the State University of New York College at Oswego on Lake Ontario. And I went to it because, well, number one, I had a Regents scholarship, which meant you had to go to school in New York State. And it was the only New York State school that made the top three in the party list school from Playboy magazine that year.
We're back to the drinking thing again.
Yeah. So I wanted to go to the party school, and I wanted to major in sociology because that sounded like something you majored in college. But I always read and I always wrote and I loved to write, and I took an English course that was called The Nature of Nonfiction, and the first assignment was to write a brief autobiographical essay. So I went off and wrote something that never happened to me, made up people, but I wrote it in the first person. It was from the point of view of someone my age, 3 pages. And I handed it in to the professor, who was a retired Air Force colonel, the biographer at the time of Amelia Earhart. And he used to correct our papers with a overhead projector so that everything you wrote was on a big screen behind him. And then he would curse at you with a red wax pen and, you know, correct your grammar and your run-on sentences. And after he did that to my piece, he said, "McDermott, I want to see you after class." And I thought he was going to say, "You can't make this stuff up."
Get out of here, yeah.
Yeah. And he said, "I got bad news for you, kid. You're a writer, and you'll never shake it." And he was right. And I knew he was right.
So how old were you when you started writing The Bigamist Daughter?
26.
And how'd you sell that book?
I had gotten my master's degree at the University of New Hampshire and studied with, it wasn't an MFA, but there were writers. I had started publishing short stories as a graduate student. And then I got married and moved to New York because my husband was in student housing. And I had time. And I thought, well, I might as well, got to write your first novel sooner or later. And Mark Smith, who was a writer, one of my professors, came down to visit us, and I told him I was writing a novel, and he said, "Okay, well, there's a great agent named Harriet Wasserman. She's Saul Bellow's agent, and I'm going to write to her, and I'm going to tell her that you are going to drop off your manuscript, whatever you've got so far." I had 100 pages of that first novel. "I'm telling Harriet that you're going to show it to her. And so once I write this letter, you have to do it," because he knew I was sort of shy about showing work. So he called me and said, "I've just mailed the letter to Harriet. You have to go down and give her your manuscript." So I was too shy. I only took 50 pages. And I literally ran it under the door of the office. I didn't want her to see me so that she wouldn't be embarrassed when she had to tell me I was an idiot and I'd never publish a novel. Ran away. The next day, Harriet called me, and said, how many more pages do you have? I said, I have 50 more pages. And she said, would you like any publishing house you would particularly like to be published by? And I said, no. And she said, do you care if you work with a male editor or a female editor? And I said, doesn't even have to be literate. If there's an editor who's interested in publishing my work, I don't care. And she said, Jonathan Galassi is a hot young editor at Houghton Mifflin. I think he'll like your work. And 2 days later, I had the contract. And I had to write the rest of it, which was awful.
So you never got rejected?
Not with a novel. I had some short stories had been rejected before
then. Oh, the rejections are so much fun. I had like 15 publishing houses say no to A Time to Kill, and about that many agents. And back then, this is the 1987-88, it was not uncommon to submit to publishers and editors at houses. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. It's just a waste of time now. But I had a list of about 20 or so agents and about 20 or so publishers, and I would go to the top five on each and send out the submission and wait for it to come back with rejection letters. I kept every rejection letter. I still got them. And the first rejection letter I got was from a senior, Herman Golub, a senior editor at Doubleday, now my publisher for the last 30 years. And it was a nice, really nice rejection letter. He said, and I knew for the book to get to his desk, someone had to pass it up.
Right.
And I got the letter, and I ran home and showed it to my wife, and I said, look, Renee, what a great rejection letter, okay? I didn't know what I was doing. And that went on for some period of time, I wasn't too worried about it. I mean, it was a little hobby I was pursuing. It was not I wasn't doing it for a living. I had a day job, but it was, it came to an end quick enough, and I had got an agent, and he then took A Time to Kill back around to everybody else who already said no to it, and they said no again. Mm. And then he found this small, unknown, brand new publishing company in New Jersey, and they bought A Time to Kill. And they printed 5,000 hardback copies and published it in June of 89, 30 years ago.
Wow.
And the book was a total flop. I mean, it didn't sell anywhere. Around Memphis, where we were living. It sold real well in Memphis, and that was it. It never went back for a second printing, and it never went back for paperback or foreign rights or anything. It just died. And then 18 months later, when The Firm came out, it found an audience pretty fast, and people realized there was an earlier book, and we couldn't get the publisher to print anyway. So the first book is now the bestseller of all of them. So funny how different story.
What do publishers know, what really?
Do you put too much of yourself in your characters and therefore restrict their potential in the story?
The settings that I've chosen for most of my novels are somewhat familiar to me. I mean, many of them, certainly, I've never experienced. I write from times that I didn't actually live in. But the characters are not me or even people I know. Even if they start out that way, the confluence of the time, the place, the circumstance, the story, the plot, the characters I hadn't expected who show up, they will have to change. It's one reason why I don't write nonfiction, because the impulse to change is just too strong in me. I couldn't write an accurate, real character if I tried, because I want to make them up. I took a journalism class and got straight A's as an undergrad because I made up every interview that I said. I went and I did the interviews, and I talked to the people, and they were so inarticulate and didn't say anything eloquent, and I got back to my desk, and I just made it a little bit better.
That's fake news 30 years ago.
That's fake news. But I knew enough. I knew that meant I was a fiction writer, and I should stay with it and claim it. It's not that you write about yourself when you're writing fiction. What it is that you put yourself at the service of your characters. So if I have a character who is looking at her newborn baby, who she is and the circumstances of that baby's birth and her marriage and her economic situation and all that, all of those things belong to her. But I can lend her something of what I felt in that circumstance. It will not be the same because we are not the same. Our circumstances are not the same. She's a character in a constructed universe. So I can lend that. It's not that the focus is on me, the writer, or my experience. It's that I am allowing a character to make use of my experience to become completely their own. I never feel like I'm doing therapy when I'm writing fiction. I save the therapy for after I write the fiction.
Is there a character that may be semi-autobiographical?
Gosh, probably my first novel is as close to only in the fact that the main character works at a vanity press, and I had worked at a vanity press.
I was going to ask you that. Were you as cruel as she was?
No. Everything else was made up, but I did have the sense of what went on. These are publishers that writers pay to get their books published, kind of scammy.
But there had to be a good deal of autobiography in That Night, your second book, which is in the suburbs, early 1960s. That book resonated with me because we were in the suburbs, the 1960s, mm-hmm. in a very strict religious home, mm-hmm. different types of religions, but still mm-hmm. they were very strict. When we got to the suburbs, we were lucky to get there because mm-hmm. we came off the farm, mm-hmm. and that had been the existence of my ancestors for a long time, and getting right. off that farm was a huge step for us.
And a lot of the impulse for That Night, my second novel, was to sort of redeem the portrait of suburbia that I was seeing in fiction and in popular culture. And that book began with the incident that actually begins the novel. And the autobiographical part of it was, it seemed to me that I had heard people talk about a girl who got pregnant and her boyfriend came and with his friends and drove up on the lawn. I didn't witness it, but I'd heard my older brothers talk about it, and people seemed to cite it as the aberration, that it was such an idyllic time to be right. young in the suburbs and it was safe. And then this, the fact that there were boys who yelled out curses was something everybody seemed to remember. So I thought, well, that's a good thing. That's a way into this story. I will write about these boys coming into this quiet suburb. When the book came out, my two older brothers told me, that's not what happened at all. You had it completely wrong. It wasn't that she was pregnant. It was that she had eloped to Maryland, spent one night with her new husband, changed her mind, left him, came back to Long Island, and was hiding in her bedroom when he came and tried to pull her out of the house. So I tried to write an autobiographical novel, but I got it all wrong. I thought she was pregnant, and in my book, she was pregnant. You know?
I like your story better.
I did, too.
Those are really chaotic times.
Yes, yeah.
From it was a cultural revolution, it was the war, it was the civil rights movement, it was the assassinations, it was the music, it was the drugs, it was... And my parents were not prepared for what was about to hit them.
Nobody was. Yeah.
None of them were, because suddenly we had all these temptations and all these freedoms that we wanted because the other kids were doing it.
Right.
You know, and it was just this constant tension at the house and not really good days. We are out of time. Thank you, Alice McDermott, for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the John Grisham Writers Hour, produced by WMRA and James Madison University's College of Arts and Letters. Special thanks to John Grisham and Alice McDermott, along with JMU Creative Writing Professor Inman Majors. WMRA's Executive Director is Matt Bingay, and I'm Chris Boros. If you missed any of the interview, it's archived at WMRA.org.